Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back great guest co-host, Dr. Adiya Hines. Welcome, Adiya.
Hi, happy to be here.
We are really excited to have some great research that matters, in addition to which we're going to have a conversation today with Dr. Deidre Barrett, Associate Professor of Psychology at Harvard and Editor of the American Psychological Association's journal Dreaming, about what goes on in our brains when we dream. You ever dream?
All the time.
Yeah, me as well. It's something that's so common, so interesting. I'm really looking forward to that conversation. First, though, we have some interesting research that matters. And let's talk about this very first one, which is, should we be talking to ourselves in the third person to control stressful situations? What's this about?
I know. I thought this was pretty bizarre, too.
I said to myself, self, this is a strange kind of conversation. Okay, what are we talking about here?
So we're talking about this study that showed that talking to yourself in the third person when you're experiencing a stressful event can actually help you control your emotions. And I thought that was really interesting. And what's so great about sort of these two studies that showed this is that they actually used different types of measures of like ways of measuring brain activity that showed using these objective measures that we can actually
cut down on the stress of the moment, perhaps.
Yes.
So let's see how this would work. I'm feeling tremendous amount of stress because I've got too many things going on at the same time. And I can either kind of lash out at someone, I could get real quiet, or I could say, you know, Adam, you're experiencing a lot of stress right now. Perhaps you should just acknowledge that stress. And by saying that, perhaps I'm able to better handle the stress and maybe not get quite as upset. Is that the way it works?
Yeah, it seems like such a simple solution for a lot of everyday problems.
Right. But people would look at us kind of like we're kind of crazy, right? Like he's talking to himself again.
Talking to himself about himself.
But it seems as if that actually really, and there's research behind it. And this was in the journal Scientific Reports. It's a journal, Nature journal. These are major studies. And it does seem to be particularly helpful when there's a painful emotional experiences to use this kind of talk. This is a nice way of identifying them if you can.
Right.
Great research. Let's talk about our next research that matters, which is kind of a gross piece of research. It has to do with dirty sponges. I think I probably used sponges longer than I should have.
Same here.
Yeah, particularly after this particular study that suggests that 362 different species of bacteria were living in these sponges.
Yeah, and I thought it was pretty frightening that they mentioned that this is the same amount of bacteria you can find in human stool samples. Ooh, not the way that I want to think about my sponge.
No, and I didn't even know that people actually put their sponges in their microwaves, apparently, that's a common way of trying to sterilize the sponge, but apparently it doesn't fully work either.
Yeah, the sponge seems to be particularly good at attracting those bacteria. It seems to be like the perfect environment for the bacteria to live and thrive because it's very warm and it's wet and there's just lots of space for the bacteria to grow. So I was trying to think, you know, how can I reduce the waste? How can I, you know, is the solution really that I have to throw away my sponge, you know, every couple of, you know, weeks or months or so? Or is there a way for me to kind of clean it up? And it sounds like you can. You know, you can run it through the washing machine in really, really hot water. You can soak it in some bleach. But even after that point, the bacteria are pretty hardy and still seem to live. So,
yeah, some of these sponges probably need to be thrown away. Because one of the things is that you get rid of the easy to kill bacteria, but the ones that are left are kind of like developing some resistance. It's kind of like treating antibiotics,
yes.
You know? And so you wonder about other ways of just cleaning. But it certainly is food for thought, a pun intended on this particular one. Let's talk about our next research that matters. And this is something that I think you as a new learner must be really interested in, which is a potential. And I say potential because I don't think it's in full time yet, but it could be home testing for HPV, or human papillomavirus.
Yes, and this new study actually comes from the UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health, which is particularly exciting and was published online in the journal Sexually Transmitted Diseases. So we know that a little over 12,000 women in the U.S. are going to be diagnosed with invasive cervical cancer, and about a third, unfortunately, do pass away from this really preventable disease. But most of the cases occur in women who've actually never been screened for one reason or another. It might be lack of access to care, or it might be some embarrassment surrounding the test itself. But in this test, Dr. Smith, they recruited women in North Carolina who were overdue for their pap smear, and they sent a test home, you know, to their houses where they could collect the specimen in the privacy of their own home and send that back in for analysis. And it was pretty successful. They showed that about 15% of these women who tested positive for human papillomavirus, which we know is associated with cervical cancer, 82% of them actually followed up with their doctor and came in for the pap smear. So I think this is a huge success story.
Yeah, the flip side is that there were close to 18% who maybe got diagnosed with the human papillomavirus who didn't follow up. And we worry. And then we also wonder, what's it like to have a test diagnosis that could be worrisome for cancer or a precursor to cancer be given perhaps on the phone or in things? I mean, there's lots of questions here, but the good news would be there's so many people who perhaps can't get in to see the doctor who don't. There are lots of barriers to getting a pap smear. And so this might ultimately be something that's really helpful. It's a different way of getting at the same thing. I'm really excited by it.
Me too.
Good. I'm glad it was our colleagues too.
Yes.
Let's talk about our last research that matters, which is about social isolation and loneliness. And these were two, we call them meta-analyses, where they put together hundreds of different studies, really looking at something that I know Christy and I, and we've talked about on the show before, but the research on social loneliness showing it's a major, major risk factor for bad health.
Yeah. These studies showed that loneliness and kind of the social isolation may actually be a bigger hazard, you know, from a public health perspective than obesity. And just given sort of our aging population, particularly when we think about our baby boomers, you know, this will be a very serious issue for our society, you know, in the very near future.
Yeah, I agree. You know, we know certain things. Like, for instance, we know the highest risk of actually people committing suicide happens to be older white men. And some of this is thought that it has to do with social isolation. A spouse dies, they don't have the same perhaps social networks, and they're isolated. And so one of the things that I think that we have to deal with in the next generation for learning and teaching in medical school would be, can we teach social skills training for residents to teach to children? And should doctors really talk about ways of increasing social connectedness? And should we screen for these? These are great questions that I think that we're going to have to grapple with, because it shows that if we do, we might actually help out.
Yeah, we might even decrease mortality, which
would be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Good research. And that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Deidre Barrett, Associate Professor of Psychology at Harvard University and the editor of the American Psychological Association's journal Dreaming, about what goes on in our brain when our heads hit the pillow. We're going to take a short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Adia Hines. Today on Conversations, Adia, we're talking with Dr. Deidre Barrett, Associate Professor of Psychology at Harvard and editor of the American Psychological Association's journal Dreaming, about what goes on in our brain when our heads hit the pillow. Welcome, Dr. Barrett.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
This is a topic that I think Adia and I are really excited about. I know our listeners will be really excited about. because it's something that is probably shared across the world and which is maybe is not understood as well as it needs to be. So tell us a little bit, though, about your background and how did you get interested in dreaming?
Well, you know, just through my own dreams. I mean, as a child, people's dream recall really varies in just how much they remember and how vivid their dreams are. And most dream researchers are pretty high recallers with vivid dreams themselves. Because if your own dreams are very interesting and you're remembering a ton of them, that's a, you know, a very natural way to get interested in dreams. So I think some psychologists go into psychology and then pick a specialty, but it was more like I was always interested in dreams. And somewhere like junior high or high school, I realized that if you were going to get paid to just think and talk about dreams, you better major in psychology.
That's amazing. What would you say is the basis for how people think about dreaming?
Yeah, I think people are just inherently interested in dreams because of the nature of the phenomena. You just drop into this other world and have these adventures that evaporate as you wake up. I think that you don't have to be taught by your culture to be interested. Certainly cultures teach things about what is the nature of this and whether you should rely on information from this state. But I think it's just inherently interesting, and that the only people that aren't very interested in dreams are the ones that have very low dream recall, or whose dreams are extremely vague or mundane, or if you just don't have that strong personal experience. And even then, some people get interested in why they're not having these experiences that, you know, other people around them are talking about.
You just said something that I find really interesting, just about how different cultures interpret dreams. What are some of the most interesting interpretations you've seen about dreams or definitions of their significance, maybe outside of the U.S.?
Well, I mean, what I'm the most interested in is how many tribal societies far back in history and around the world, and some of the few societies that are still practicing hunting-gathering type lifestyles now. And it's a gross generalization, but they tend to put a lot of emphasis on dreams for guidance. It might tell them how to make a hunting implement better, or it might tell them how to build a hut. And if they hear a song in their dream, you know, they explicitly, you know, everybody expects you to wake up and write that down and sing it. So the idea that dreams may have practical information for waking life is in most tribal societies. Now, they also tend to think that dreams represent some second real world, or the gods are communicating in dreams, or ancestors are communicating in dreams. They very often think that this important information is sort of coming from some specific source, and that varies more across cultures. I think there's a lot of wisdom to that. But post-agriculture, there's been even more emphasis on dreams in relation to religious beliefs. One of the interesting things in the Christian world is that in the Bible, dreams are essentially always positive. God or angels are sending the dreams, and there are numerous examples of people getting valuable information in dreams in both the Old and New Testament. And yet, for the vast majority of Christian history, the actual practicing priests tended to view dreams as the work of the devil and had all sorts of things about how demons were appearing to you in the form of other things in your dreams, and that dream interpretation was some sort of anti-Christian demonic tradition. So the actual written tenets of Christianity are very pro-dream, but the practice through early Christianity and medieval and, you know, pretty much on to 150 years ago was pretty anti-dream.
You know, it's interesting coming from the Jewish faith, as you mentioned, a lot of the Old Testament stories really do have dreams. And in a lot of the dreams, there's a lot of wrestling going on. And and interpreting really is so important. If we were to fast forward to, you know, the 20th century, when did we begin to really understand the science of dreams, and where are we in understanding what that really is?
Well, the brain science of state and what's going on physiologically in the brain, that pretty much got its big leap start in the 1950s when EEGs, electroencephalographs, were developed enough, and they were being used for monitoring seizures first and all sorts of other things. But then in the early 50s, a group decided to monitor sleepers with an EEG machine and quickly found that there was this 90-minute cycle of you go to sleep and your brain becomes increasingly less active over a period of 90 minutes, and then all of a sudden it looks as active as when you're awake, except you're not awake. And then quickly after that, they found that this period of lots of activity in the brain and eye movements, for which they named it rapid eye movement sleep or REM, that period was when most dreams seem to occur, highly correlated with dreaming. And if you awaken people from REM sleep, that they recall dreams. And if you awaken them from this much less activated part of sleep, that they didn't usually recall dreams. So the discovery of the REM non-REM cycle in the early 1950s was really the jump start to modern, you know, brain research on the topic.
If there are ways of understanding, I think a lot of people, dreams can be really scary for them. What do we know about how dreams either benefit us or have any negative effects? What do we know about kind of that physical and mental health interplay in dreaming?
Well, I think dreams have much more potential beneficial effect. I mean, I think of them as just thinking in a really different biochemical state. Our brain is as active in REM sleep as when we're awake, but different neurotransmitters are more active, different areas of the brain are more active. But I think that we're just still basically thinking about all of our usual thoughts and concerns. And the question of whether dreams can be dangerous or bad for you is almost like asking whether thought might be dangerous or bad for you. Well, you know, there's some scary thoughts, and maybe there's some paths our thoughts can go down that are, you know, are not in our best interest, but overall thinking is, you know, a healthy thing that our brain needs to be doing. So I think that most dreams, even most frightening dreams, potentially have something to tell us about ourselves, that thinking about why we're, you know, dreaming about that particular scary image or what happened today that's having us have a nightmare today when we don't usually, that the interpretive stuff is helpful whether the dream is good or bad. But I do think there's one exception to that, which is post-traumatic nightmares. And I think that they are probably mostly really negative for the people that have them. I think that for any other kind of nightmare, like why you're dreaming about a witch chasing you down the hall and why on this night, and, you know, kind of thinking about what in your waking life gives you that feeling in the pit of your stomach that the witch does, you know, that the interpretation is useful. But for a post-traumatic nightmare, there's no mystery to why you're dreaming about a burning building collapsing around you or about getting raped or about being in a firefight and having your buddy shot to death right next to you, if that's really happened to you in your waking life and you're re-experiencing that every night in your dream. I think that probably post-traumatic nightmares were useful in evolutionary history, and that's why we have them, that back, I mean, almost all of our behaviors and experiences were really fine-tuned by evolution for life on the savanna, and sort of the amount of time we've been away from that is blink of an eye in evolutionary time. So we haven't had time to change genetically from that. And so I think that for tribal people, that if some horrible trauma happened to you, it was likely to happen again. I mean, if the tribe on the other side of the hill came over and attacked your village, they were likely to do that again. If some wild animal got into your hut in the middle of the night, it or another member of its species was likely to do that again. So I think that in evolutionary times, that having a vivid nightmare that made it feel like the experience had just happened, so you never got over that fear and you kept being on guard about it for a long time, was probably adaptive. It probably saved people's lives and, had them bolster their huts more and stake a guard, watching for the other tribe. But now in modern times, the nature of traumatic experiences is not that they're likely to repeat to the same individual. I mean, the World Trade Towers can't fall down in front of you again. And someone who got raped recently is not significantly likelier to get raped than any other woman on the planet. So I think that post-traumatic nightmares are trying to keep us scared and keep us feeling like this thing just happened, and that used to be very helpful, and that now it's very destructive to people's psychological well-being and getting on with your life after a trauma.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Deidre Baird, Associate Professor of Psychology at Harvard and the editor of the American Psychological Association's journal Dreaming. And I know we want to talk about some of your books and some of your research and what goes into the journal even. But we're going to take a short break, but we'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Dia Hines. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health Radio with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Adia Hines. We've been talking with Dr. Barrett, Associate Professor of Psychology at Harvard and the editor of the American Psychological Association's journal Dreaming, about what goes on in our brain when our head hit the pillow. Before we took our break, Dr. Barrett, you were talking about how some of these sort of post-traumatic dreams may have been protective in sort of ancient society, but may not be so much now. I was wondering what advice you had for us and our listeners about how we might try to sort of temper or control those dreams that we experience that might be a bit frightening.
Well, very specifically for the post-traumatic nightmares that I was talking about before the break, I think that it's useful to practice dream incubation, trying to influence the content of your dreams. And people can try this on their own, although working with a trained therapist is even likelier to produce an effect. But basically, if you tell yourself you want to have a certain kind of dream as you're falling asleep, it often influences the content of the dream. So for post-traumatic nightmares, if I start dreaming about, X, whatever the traumatic event is, I want the dream to take this other path. I fight off my attacker, water comes and puts out the fire, whatever somebody finds would be a sort of satisfactory other ending to that dream. If you picture that ending and say you want to dream that to yourself, for a lot of people, that will not only end the nightmares, but they'll have a sort of mastery dream that carries over into feeling better in the present and more like the trauma is behind them. But I don't advocate that for other nightmares. I think understanding them is more interesting, and I wouldn't do more with those than just at bedtime. If I have a nightmare, I want it to be clearer to me what it's about, something like that. And dream incubation can be very useful for if you want to dream on why you're having, fights with your husband or boyfriend, if you want to dream about why you've been so depressed lately, if it doesn't seem obviously reactive to something you already know about. Or some people get a lot of really practical help from their dreams. I mean, chemists make breakthroughs in science in their dreams. So if you're stuck on a professional work problem, I want to have a dream that will show me a different approach to this, has been very useful to many people.
When you talk about purposeful dreaming, if you're having dreams that are disturbing, does that help interpret them So if you're having a dream that, you know, I can have a dream and I can just say, well, I'm not sure about the total interpretation, but if I'm being chased by someone with a gun, that tends to be in something anxious. But how do I make that leap to, this can help me with dealing with some things that are causing anxiety in my life?
Well, I think that, I mean, we can do a lot of, on the bad dreams, we can do a lot of waking interpretation, wake up and sort of stay with that feeling in your dream. What does it remind you of in your waking life? Associate to, you know, to the object that was scary in the dream and do some basic dream interpretation awake. But yes, you definitely can use the incubation that you would use for problem solving to try to understand the dream more. Either just some statement to yourself that you want your dreams to be clearer what they're about, or the next time I have the nightmare about the witch chasing me, I want to remember to turn around and ask her who she is and why she's chasing me. So definitely incubation at bedtime can carry over and influence nighttime dreams. In my book, The Committee of Sleep, I write about some of the kind of dramatic, you know, Nobel Prize winning sort of breakthroughs people have achieved in their dreams, both spontaneously, but lots of people stumble on this incubating dreams on purpose kind of thing. But I did a study with college students where I had them just take very mundane problems like their homework problems or other objective things that they had to solve but hadn't solved yet, and had them promise not to work on them awake for a week and go over the problem at bedtime and self-suggest that they were going to dream about it. And in the course of 1 week of doing that, half of the students had a dream that they and blind judges judged as about the problem on the topic. So half of the students in a week of doing that dreamed about their problem. And then a third, as rated by them, had a dream that solved it. And a fourth of them, as rated by the blind judges, had a dream that solved it. And the ones that the dreamers versus the judges disagreed on were more metaphoric. The students felt like they saw the answer in their dream, but it wasn't as literal as the ones that the judges agreed.
Where can people get a copy of that book, The Committee of Sleep? It sounds like it's something could be really quite interesting for lots of our listeners.
Amazon is the short answer to that. I think it's some of the other online bookstores. It's been out long enough that it's not in every brick-and-mortar bookstore anymore, but it's in a number of libraries, and it's on Amazon.
Well, we'll put a link of that on our website.
And speaking of which, you've done all of this amazing research, great studies, you've written these books. So it sounds like you've talked to many, many people about their dreams over the years. And I'm wondering, what are some of the stories that have surprised you the most?
Well, early in my career, I was sort of surprised to encounter what I was just describing, the idea that literally Nobel Prize winning scientific discoveries were dreamed by their creators, or the story of Kekulé discovering the structure of the benzene ring, that dreams could be that much about something very objective, or could be that practical, you know, a breakthrough for the waking world, because that's not what the majority of dream content seems to be about, our personal emotional things. So I spent a lot of time studying that, and it no longer surprises me to hear, you know, colleagues in other departments at Harvard describing some, you know, major discovery of theirs as coming from a dream, because I've made a point of seeking out those stories and of working on how you can increase the likelihood of that happening. But that really did, I had very vivid dreams, but I hadn't had such a practical problem solving my dream myself when I started hearing those things.
I think this is really all quite amazing, and I know that we would love to continue really understanding more about dreaming, and you teach a course or two on dreaming, and I think we want to get into that course. You need to you're going to need to keep a spot open up here for some distant learners to learn more about it. And I think we'd like to actually follow some of the research, because it sounds like the science, what I'm hearing is that this goes back to antiquity, to the founding of our species, but the science is one that's just starting to catch up.
Yes, and I mean, I'm a clinical psychologist, but I understand you guys are general practitioners. And I think there's a role for dreams in medicine. When I used to work in a health psychology program, I always found it useful. And then people there were bringing in presenting complaints that were back pain. And, you know, somebody thought that they might benefit from psychological interventions, but they were physical problems. And I always made it a point to, in the initial interview, ask everyone if they'd had any dream that they thought was related to whatever their main presenting complaint was, and at least half of them would say no, and the question would have taken 2 seconds, and we would move on. But almost 50% would say yes, and sometimes they'd tell a dream that was very literally about, you know, the back pain would show up in the dream, and other times they would just feel it was related and it would be very metaphoric and, again, not like something blind judges might see as related. But I frequently found that the dream they would recount seemed to tell me something about their problems from a very different perspective than I'd gotten just from questioning them in the usual waking world way. And so I think that can be true in general medicine. And like I say, it's not that everybody will come up with something, but it takes 2 seconds for the ones who say no. And then it gets you interesting, kind of unconscious, other perspective on the problem.
Since 2/3 of what comes into primary care has a primary psychological basis,
Yeah. It
seems like we could open up some doors. And I think you're opening up perspectives for our listeners. And we really, really appreciate your time and expertise talking about dreams and research with your health listeners.
It's been interesting talking with you. And love to hear any stories that you have in the future about dreams in your practice.
Well, we appreciate that. We've been talking with Dr. Deidre Barrett, Associate Professor of Psychology at Harvard and the editor of the American Psychological Association's journal Dreaming and editor of the book The Committee of Sleep, about what goes on in our brain when our heads hit the pillow. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Dia Hines. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And Adia, if a listener has a question they want us to address on an upcoming show, they can just send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question about someone who's having arthritis in the knee, a pretty common and difficult problem.
My mother has knee pain from arthritis, and she wants to explore whether over-the-counter hyaluronic. Thank you, that one. Acid would be helpful. Can she take 100 milligrams twice a day? Should she be concerned about any side effects or adverse effects?
Well, first off, knee arthritis is probably one of the most common conditions that we see, you see, I see, and we know that the end result of surgery is right now really one of the few things that actually really can dramatically affect it. So we're trying to figure out how we kind of avoid that surgery or delay it or at the very least help people with some of the pain. What sort of things are your standard armamentarium, Adia? What do you normally think about with arthritis?
Well, initially we attempt sort of a limited course of just anti-inflammatories, your typical Advil or ibuprofen and the appropriate dose kind of over the counter taken with food to see if that helps. That coupled with physical therapy and other sort of conservative measures, ice, heat, are kind of our first line defense against this pain, dealing with knee pain. And then if we don't see any relief with those conservative measures, we start to think about kind of more invasive tests and also therapies. Definitely would consider, you know, some type of imaging to take a closer look at that knee and see if there might be something kind of more serious that's contributing to the pain. Certainly if the person has swelling or fevers or anything more serious, we might think about something more systemic that might be contributing to the pain. And then we start thinking about kind of more invasive measures like injections that could be helpful.
Yeah, and this hyaluronic acid, which is some people might understand it as kind of like artificial cartilage, and a lot of that research has been done on injections into the knee, and that's been done and still is done, though the benefits are really considered in many respects clinically not really significant. So it's not necessarily clinically recommended. Some people will do it and some people will offer that surgery, but it's not always something that I think we as family doctors are always recommended. But I do know that people really do want to take something. And so then the question is the oral medication going to be helpful? Again, this isn't something that I feel is likely to provide the majority of people with any substantial benefit. I don't know, Adia, if you've had other thoughts on that.
No, I definitely agree with you there, Adam. Not sure about the benefits of the oral.
You know, and the question is that going to be any more beneficial than taking, for the discomfort, acetaminophen, which is probably the safest thing that one can take, and probably that and physical therapy. Ah, physical therapy, something we can all agree on. Thank you so much for your question. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I seem to be hearing a lot of rumblings about the health benefits of turmeric lately. Is there any truth to them?
Well, it is the herbal medicine du jour, and I do have a lot of patients. I hear about this. I know weekly talk about that they really are interested in using turmeric to fight off inflammation and to have its anti-inflammatory effects. Do you hear about this at all?
I've heard about this, but you know, I really don't know that much. I'm interested to hear your thoughts.
Well, I think that there are emerging research on potential benefits. The randomized clinical controlled trials, we don't necessarily have them at the levels that we can actually recommend it. And like any of the spices and herbs that one can get, obviously if one takes too much, it can be a problem. But I do think this is one of those ones that clinically, if people tell me they're using and they feel that they're getting benefits, I'll say that's good. I think that the research is more positive than negative here. And this is one of those things that a lot of people have been using for hundreds, if not thousands of years, that perhaps if we can learn how to best apply it and at what doses, that's when we could really be beneficial.
Learn something new every day.
Looking forward to it. What's our very last house call?
I have an old back injury. Recently, I signed up for a monthly massage membership. Obviously, the massage will be relaxing either way, but what should I say to my therapist to make sure that it's helpful for my back?
I would say kudos to you for signing up for this monthly massage membership. This is something I could go for.
Yeah, and if you can't use it, let us know. We'll try to just, you know, we'll suck it up and we'll fill in.
Huge sacrifice, right? I would say, you know, you definitely want to talk to your therapist about the details of the injury, where exactly it was located, and, you know, whether or not you had any surgeries performed to rectify it. This is one of those situations where you're right to be a bit careful and ensure that the massage does not exacerbate or sort of cause the previous injury to flare up again.
Yeah, I think it's one of those common sense things. If it doesn't feel right, it probably isn't. Mm-hmm. You know, trust your instincts here. If it's really painful, and I've had massages that have been way too painful, and, you know, I wake up the next day and I'm much worse than I was beforehand. Now, someone say, well, you know, you needed that. Well, I don't really think so. On the other hand, it probably, if I didn't feel anything, it may not be get the benefit enough of therapeutic touch. So there's probably a nice middle ground there where they can be stretched and looked. But how do you feel the next day? Are you feeling better and stronger? You got to trust your own instincts. That'll conclude the house calls today. We want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today on Your Health. If you have any questions or concerns, you can send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great co-host, Dr. Dia Hines, and our guest today, Dr. Deidre Barrett. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
I'm Dr. Dia Hines.
And we look forward to talking to you next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.